Suzanne Rodway is the Chief Data Protection Officer at NatWest Group. When she was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis in young adulthood, she had to make many adjustments, not least the necessity to question her own assumptions, especially the ones about how others perceived her. That is hard to do when other senior leaders are confused about you being ambitious. You're ambitious despite your condition was something Suzanne was asked. She challenged and still challenges those perceptions head on. As the only senior leader at NatWest Group with a visible disability, Suzanne feels a strong sense of responsibility and duty to advocate for others, helping her peers recognise the barriers many, many face. Suzanne's advice? Don't look down. Look up and look out. We dive into this and much more in our conversation. Suzanne Rodway, I am so looking forward to this conversation. I wonder if we could start by you sharing with the viewers your view about why the topic of inner confidence means so much to people who have lived experience of disability and neurodivergence.
I think it's incredibly important. I think we face a lot of barriers in our life, and I think we get quite used to being quite introverted and being grateful when little things go our way, and when things seem a bit easier, we'll sort of take it, and we sort of start to lose our confidence of wanting more, thinking we deserve more, thinking it's a right to have the same as everyone else. You start to get used to this is good enough. And I think it's really important that we have that confidence to actually be able to say, no, that isn't good enough. I should have more, whether that's career, whether that's education, whether that's ability to go to the shops like everyone else, whether that's ability to participate in social activities. I think it's really important we continue to build that confidence, but I think it can be really, really hard. And I think in a post-COVID anxiety-ridden world, that's even harder. I think, you know, it's hard for everyone, but I think it's particularly hard for our community.
Yeah. You know, you touch on a point that is often missed. I hear often this analogy that if you've been lying in a ditch for so long, it starts to get comfortable down there. So you touch on the necessity sometimes to notice those moments when we need to look up and out and see what we've maybe been putting up with.
I think you do. And also, I think it's incredibly helpful when other people notice it. You get quite used to it. You're like, oh, this is normal. It'll take me an extra 20 minutes to go to a bathroom because I'll have to find the one disabled one. I'll have to work out if my wheelchair fits. I'll then have to spend 10 minutes negotiating the actual angles, you know, waiting for the other people who use it, even though they don't need it. You know, that's just normal. And it's interesting when you go with people, whether that's out and about or whether that's just to your office for me, and people go, wow, I'd never seen that. And again, you're so used to it. You're like, oh, this is normal. And they're like, no, but it shouldn't be. And I think having that fresh perspective is quite helpful, as well as our own sometimes. And certainly working with a disabled and neurodivergent community, you know, I'm very used to my own situation as a wheelchair user, but I see so many other things where I'm like, that's not good enough. And it's amazing how you sort of lose your advocacy for yourself, but you see it. I see something that's not accessible for a blind colleague and I'm like, oh, well, we need to fix that. But oh, it's all right that I can't get in the front door. You know, it's really interesting that it's easier to be strong for others sometimes than it is for yourself.
Yeah, so true. So true. So Suzanne, when I founded Purple Space, I did so with a prediction that the curation of inspiration and ideas and assets and know-how to support people with disabilities and neurodivergence to build our inner confidence was going to be as important as the leadership know-how we deliver to disability ERG leaders. And we're seeing that. So this suite of Confident Conversation, this series that we're running, is really about asking remarkable individuals like yourself with extraordinary careers to share something of your story and the things that you have learnt along the way when it comes to building confidence and resilience. And one look at your CV, one would be fooled into thinking you've sussed it from the get-go. But we've been getting to know each other over the last few months, and that's not always been the case. So can we start at the beginning, a little bit of a once upon a time, and you share with us a bit about your career journey and how you got to do what you do, and then we will tuck into that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll sort of play in where my disability comes in, because I wasn't born as a wheelchair user, along the way as it sort of runs in parallel. So I thought from a young age I wanted to be a lawyer. Embarrassingly, I very much liked LA Law when I was young. Very aging when you start to say which program was it, LA Law, was it Ally McBeal, was it, or was it Suits, as I found someone recently. I was like, oh, I'm very old. But I knew I wanted to be a lawyer. And so that was always the kind of the path. So, you know, worked hard at school, knew I'd go to university, knew I would likely want to be a lawyer. Didn't study law at uni. I studied English language and literature and then went to law school. And I'd started to notice a problem with particularly my right hip, but both my hips, when I was in my early teens. And I first really noticed it on a dry ski slope, where it turned out I could turn right by leaning on my left leg, but I couldn't turn left by leaning on my right leg. So I would have been fine skiing down a mountain clockwise, provided you only went in circles. And at the time, it was sort of, is it just a growing pain thing? Is it just a teenage girl thing? What kind of is it? And if I don't ski, then I might be all right. And you know, it didn't feel quite right, but it wasn't there all the time. So it wasn't something I really even factored into my thinking. By the time I got to law school, so after I'd graduated university and I went straight to law school, I was having sort of flare-ups where my hips were quite bad and I needed to use crutches to help me walk comfortably. And it was the first time that I found myself being different from others, because when it came to my law school finals, I couldn't sit in the same room as everyone else because it was upstairs and I couldn't get up the stairs. So I did my exams in a tutor's room by myself.
What were you thinking and feeling during this time? Because that's quite something. You know, we start our life, we have some assumptions about our career and our journey, and quite often health can just derail us.
Yeah.
So what were your thoughts and feelings as you were navigating this?
I was fabulously young and naive and didn't really see it as necessarily a long-term thing. Hadn't really appreciated what it might mean for future. I was very focused on the kind of here and now, and here and now it means this. I need to pass my exams. This is the way I do it. They've made an accommodation for me. It's actually quite nice sitting in a room by myself, cracking on with the quiet, not listening to all the others. And I had some lovely friends at uni, and we made quite a joke of it. There'd be a lot of watch out, lame woman coming through, you know, nonsense, to just, you know, put everyone at ease with the with how it was. And at that stage, I was in a phase of, if I rested sufficiently afterwards, I would have a period of no flare, no pain, and I wouldn't need to use the crutches. So I was kind of like, look, it's heightened at the moment. It's stressful. It's going to be worse. I'll get through the exams. You know, it's like a university. I'll have a long summer holiday. I'll rest. And then when I eventually start work, I'll be fine. Yeah. So that was sort of where my head was at. This is fine thing for now. Well, I've got an accommodation and off I'll go.
Got you. So how did that play out? So tell us through graduation, first job.
So it didn't quite play out as planned in that. So law school was 2 years and I was up and down throughout those 2 years. I got married in between the 2 years of law school, and sort of 10 weeks before the wedding, I did the classic, I'm going to get fit and I'll look fabulous in my wedding dress and I shall have a go on a treadmill for a few minutes, just really gently. That 5 minutes on a treadmill cost me 6 months on crutches, which included my wedding. Which again wasn't something you plan for. My mother did an incredible job of the white tape that you put on cars for weddings. She wrapped my crutches in and put big bows on them, which I didn't know until I woke up in the morning and saw them. So I managed to get down the aisle without the crutches, leaning on Dad. And then I had the crutches, and then I sat, not quite Posh and Beck's thrones, but I did sit on a chair with a cushion for most of the day and received people at my wedding. So I got through my 2 years of law school, and sadly I was having another flare-up when I started my training contract at a city law firm. So I started work at Linklaters. As a trainee lawyer, you're put in a room with a more senior lawyer to work with. So I turn up on my crutches thinking, trainees do a lot of the kind of grunt work. Yeah. You know, how is that going to work when I can't get around terribly easily? And astonishingly, through no actual planning, just by pure luck, the principal that I sat with was a woman who just had a double hip replacement. So she was a young lawyer in her 30s who'd had problems with her joints from birth. And she'd just come back from that. So she was so empathetic and understanding and called us the whiz-bang hip room. And so when we had to go to court, and normally the trainee would carry all the boxes, and she'd insist that you come along, you can carry the boxes. She's not carrying them. So that I was so incredibly lucky that that was my start, because it could have been so very different. I watched some of the other people that some of my peers sat with who were, you know, not the most empathetic or generous humans at all, let alone if you actually had an additional complexity to what you were doing. And she was focused purely on my capabilities as a lawyer, and just the fact that I couldn't manoeuvre very easily was irrelevant. And that set me off on such a good path of, this is always going to be about what I can do. I'm very lucky. I want a career that requires my brain.
Yeah.
And for me, that works. And the rest of me is sort of irrelevant to it. And that's how I kind of started. And then that just became kind of known at Linklaters. And I was still in phases, yeah, of flare-ups and not. So I'd sometimes be on the crutches, not always. And during that time, I was sent to a rehab hospital for 3 weeks to try and help me to sort of learn to live with a potential condition. But I was what, 20... 21, 22, very, very young. And everyone else in there was really an elderly stroke victim. So that was very difficult, because you're like, I'm not in the same situation as these people. And everyone there was very much treated the same. And because a lot of the stroke victims and the other individuals there had mental impact on their faculties, they treated you like children. So they said your name in every sentence. Hi, Suzanne. Good morning, Suzanne. How are you, Suzanne? And you'd be like, I know my name. I found that very, you know, I'm a city lawyer. I'm racing ahead. This is really difficult. So I found that more of a...
So what was that telling you about people, and what were you learning about the need to navigate what I call other people's stuff? Yeah. The soft bigotry of low expectation. We talk about extensively at Purple Space. So what were you learning? What were you changing of yourself in order to deal with that?
I was learning a lot that I would need to explain, yeah, and advocate. So at one point they said, when you go back to work, could you work one day a week? And I said, no, I'm on a city training contract. That, you know, let me explain to you what I need to do. I want you to help me navigate this element of my life better, but I'm not going to stop my life. So how do we do that? So, you know, I want to learn how to use crutches safely and better. You know, teach me that. Teach me the meditation techniques. Teach me the relaxation techniques, but I don't need you to cut up my food.
Yeah.
So I learned to advocate for myself, and also to opt out of the bits that were of no use to me. You know, we can show you how to navigate a kitchen safely. No, I'm good with that. Thank you. I'll go and do an extra lap in the pool because that's helpful for me, while you do that with some of the other people. So I guess the thing I really learned was, I'm going to have to explain. And I guess without knowing what I was doing, it was the sort of learning to meet people where they are that we talk a lot about now, which is, I'm going to have to help educate you. I'm one of the first people you've had who is young and has a chronic pain condition rather than has an easy to fit in medical condition that you kind of know a standard pattern for. So I learned to do that. And then I had to work out, okay, and what can I take from this back to my life and my job? Because some of the things they're suggesting aren't going to be practical. So again, it was learning okay, this is going to be down to me. How do I implement these two things? And how do I manage my career that is exceptionally important to me, and I've always wanted this, whilst working out, okay, and this is the safest and best way for me to do that.
Thinking about the interaction of your own disability, the world of work, what were the things that you were needing to do or say differently in order to get the adjustments, and or was it already there? You know, you speak so highly of your colleagues at NatWest, and the work you're doing is phenomenal, leading and supporting the establishment of the network, etc. But what about you? and work, how did that play out? What were you learning about yourself?
I found it incredibly hard to begin with.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know at what stage during that period I considered myself disabled, but in the first part, I know I didn't, and I know I do now, but I don't know quite where along the journey I suddenly found myself thinking, oh, okay, this is a permanent thing. And I think it really started to crystallize for me when I was using the crutches full time by then. And the number of interactions I had with people who'd go, oh, I know what that's like. I broke my leg last summer.
Yeah.
And I used to get angrier and angrier with that. No, you don't know what it's like. You had that as a temporary thing. This is my life. There will be no end to this.
So what did you do to gear up for an ask?
So it's funny, I spoke to a few people about it and someone suggested to me, I was still using quite NHS-y looking crutches. So I went out and bought myself some pimped up crutches. I went out and bought myself red crutches. I'm a big fan of red. And I bought myself red crutches. And again, something that looked a bit more like, this isn't I went to the NHS and they've given me these. And I got, you know, ones with specialist ergonomic handles and specialist sort of suspension in the bottom and things so that it looked a little bit more like, and that helped a bit. But I also prepared for the, I got better at the practiced answer of, oh, no, this isn't it. Because you'd get a lot of people going, oh, how long are you on those? And then you would say forever. And then you would see that look of panic on people's face of, I don't know what to do now. I don't know what to say. So I learned to go, that's why I've pimped them up. And again, try and put people at ease to the, let's just have a conversation about this. But that was a learning for me that I almost had to put them at ease.
Did you have to do that for those people who are responsible for saying yay or nay for any adjustments that you might
need? I had
to
do it for senior people who were my line managers who would have to be part of the process. Yeah. The sort of once you actually get into the formal HRE of it, not as much. But a few times I've had to be quite vocal and I've had to walk people through the, particularly that door thing was it's a massive old oak door that's about 10 feet high and I couldn't physically push it. I mean, I just wasn't strong enough. And I had to say to people, come and have a look at the door. Let's have a look at this. So there's a few of those where I've had to be quite robust and proactive. And there are days that's easier than others. There are days you are like, right, I'm on the march and off I go and I shall do this. And other days where you're like, oh, God. It's so hard and I don't want to. But in those early days, it was okay. And then when I got my rheumatoid diagnosis and I knew things were going to get worse, I had incredible support and rally. Because at that stage, I was also dealing with that mental adjustment to, okay, I've had one thing and now I've got another thing. Yeah. And this thing is going to require medication. That medication is going to have a really significant impact on my body and how I feel. That's going to impact my ability to do my job. I'm sort of grieving slightly for the things I know that will now never come because this is a progressive disease. And so trying to manage all of that and the emotions of that, let alone the then daily practicalities, is not straightforward. But I was lucky that I had a lot of support for that.
Do you see yourself as a confident person? And if you look back to your younger self, is there anything that you would say to her to fast track the process of building your inner confidence? And if you were to see that Suzanne just before she got married, you know, what would you whisper in her ear about what you've learned?
I think it would say to remain as confident as I was when I was young before all of this happened, because that had such a massive impact on my confidence. But particularly from a career ambition perspective. So once I became a full-time crutch user, I started to think that's all people could see.
Okay.
And that I had a real crisis of confidence.
So you were watching other people watch you?
To a degree, but also that classic thing you learn in CBT that I was projecting.
Yes.
What I imagined other people were seeing. So, you know, I spoke to a few people and I said, obviously, the first thing you see about me is the crutches. And they went, what are you talking about? And that wasn't necessarily, but in my head, it became a barrier that I'd created to my progression. And I got, and at that stage, I lost all the confidence. Again, when I was young, I knew I was bright. I knew if I worked hard, I'd get somewhere. I suddenly got to this point in my career, you know, when I'd been at NatWest for a period and I was now a full-time crutch user of, oh gosh, I'm lucky I've got a job. I'll just sit really quietly and hope no one notices. Because if they notice that I'm, you know, special, they might regret their choice. So I'll just sit here and I'll be grateful for that. And
wow.
And that lasted for a couple of years. And I didn't realise it.
Yeah. When did you realise it?
I started to think about my ambition. And the fact that at that stage I'd been kind of in lateral moves for a period of time. And I was starting to think, I'm not using half of the skills I've got. And this isn't great, but I don't know how to get out of this. So I applied for a chronic pain management program at St. George's, which was a 3-week intensive program and was most genuinely the life-changing experience I've ever had. It was revolutionary, and I sort of feel like everyone should go on it, irrespective of whether you have a disability or not, because just the lessons it taught me and how it taught me. But the reason I really wanted it was for the CBT element, the cognitive behavioral therapy piece.
So what was the key lesson then that you're applying now? Let's fast forward now. So you are data protection, data security, forgive me, Suzanne.
Chief Data Protection Officer.
Yeah, it's kind of something. So what is it about either that course and your journey that has been so significant that you apply now in your seniority and the impact, the influence you've got now on other individuals?
It was really that training my brain to question the voices in my head. Is there evidence for the thing my brain has jumped to? And maybe sometimes there is evidence. Sometimes people are really rude and abusive to you as a disabled person. So sometimes there is evidence. But sometimes a lot of it is people are just seeing me as a wheelchair user. No, they're not. I've just decided that. That's been incredibly helpful. And I do have to quite often take time to just, let me just reflect on that for a moment. Let me just question that. And then let me work through, okay, what am I going to do with that? So that, I think, was the most powerful element. There was some incredible stuff around pain and around learning how the brain works and some things like that that were brilliant. But for me, it was really that voices in my head thing, which I think as women anyway, who already quite often suffer with imposter syndrome, and I certainly did that, you then layer on the, oh my God, I'm a disabled woman. And I came out of that. And what they helped us do in that program was set ourselves some goals, but really set ourselves the small milestones to get to the goals.
So it was practical.
It was really practical. And I use it with people I mentor now. They made us do a sort of a bullseye grid, and it had elements for work, it had elements for social, it had elements for family, and you had to put where you were and where you wanted to be. And there was two elements I really wanted to focus on. One was I'd sort of stopped participating in a lot of family activities, and the other was career. I just sort of halted. And so I came out of that with I'm going to get myself a new job. And we were going on holiday that summer to Florida, and I'm going to get on a bunch of the rides, and I'm going to join in with the family. And those were the kind of the two big goals I set, with the small incremental goals along the way. And the group we had was only 7 of us. So we had this incredibly powerful group who stayed connected on WhatsApp 4 years later, still a few of us are on it. And you would have I'm having a bad day, but I'm going to the cricket match. I'm going to watch my son today. And yeah, go for it. Go you. And so that was very helpful. And then when it came to work, I came back and I was like, right, I'm going to do something about this. So I spoke to a sort of coach to say, right, what are the steps? And she said to me, okay, let's kind of look at your CV, what's your unique selling point, and let's get you out talking to some senior people to say, I've got some skills and I don't think they're being utilized, and I'm still ambitious.
Yeah.
And it was astonishing. I had a senior person I worked for not that long ago who, when I was talking about career, said, oh, you're ambitious in spite of your condition. And that is still very much a barrier. So I was like, okay, I'm actively going to have to go out and do that, but with this sort of newfound confidence of, I'm going to try this, right? And I didn't have a time frame, and I didn't have a specific, it was just I'm going to work towards getting myself a more senior role that I think is recognizing what I can do. And I did that.
Yeah, because you moved then from hope to a decision.
Yeah, I think that was the really big, was the I can proactively do something about this. And as with all of these things, there's an element of luck and timing, and a role came up that I applied for, and I got that, and that was my first step into a more senior position, my first time on a legal executive committee and all of those things. But it all arose from that. I'm going to set this goal. I'm going to have this confidence. I am going to go out there and I'm not going to let this hold me back.
So so Purple Space, as you know, is creating a suite of collateral and know-how. And these podcasts, these films sit within the library that we're creating about how to build inner confidence. And we recently produced some guides where we showcase some of the hurdles that we face, irrespective of the disability we have, the age of onset, the severity, etc. And so we talk often about the fundamentals to building confidence and the hurdles. I know you've seen them. What are those things that spoke to you? What would you say has been the key hurdle or the key thing that you have done to help you build and sustain your inner confidence?
Yeah, I think there's a fundamental and a hurdle that when I was reading through, I was like, yes. I mean, all of them were recognisable, but there were two that jumped out at me. And in terms of the fundamental, it was the recognise the possibility that others aren't going to understand the impact of your disability. And I think that's twofold. I think one is people will make assumptions. The classic, someone's going to talk to the person who's pushing my manual chair, not to me, because they're going to assume I have broader impact rather than just potentially mobility. And the need to help educate people around that. And as I say, you know, a very senior person saying to me, oh, you're ambitious in spite of, and having to in that moment say to them, do you realize what you just said? And watch them go, oh, yeah. And help them learn that that's not an okay assumption to make. Yeah. You wouldn't make that assumption because I'm a woman. So why would you make it because I'm in a wheelchair? There's nothing that suggests I wouldn't be ambitious.
I can't help but ask a supplementary to that, Suzanne. Do you always call that out? Or are there moments sometimes you just let it go because life's too short?
There are moments I let it go. What I will normally do is rant to someone afterwards, and sometimes they'll go, yeah, you can't let that go. I'll be like, oh, I know. And it's not for me. It's for the people that come behind me. And I take that exceptionally seriously. I'm probably the most senior visibly disabled person at the bank. So we have a leadership group of the top sort of 150, 160 people in the bank. And within that, I'm the only visibly disabled. There'll be lots of people there who are disabled or neurodivergent for whom some may have disclosed, some may have not. I'm a very visible.
So you wear that responsibility.
So I take that phenomenally seriously. And it's because of that I've advocated so much more for, actually, I can't get to the toilets on some floors. That's not good enough. What's the plan? And again, because I'm senior and because I do have access to a lot of very senior people, I can go to them directly and go, come with me. Let's watch me try and get to a bathroom. Let's watch me try and get some lunch. Watch me in this vicinity to try then and advocate for the others, because I have that platform, whereas there are others who can't. And if I won't speak for myself, and you know, I'm confident I'm in a senior position, I'm quite robust in many ways.
It's a super privilege.
It is, and I think it's exceptionally important. Throughout my career, I took the I'm a senior working mother very seriously, and I saw that as a role model. I really see my disability advocacy as an exceptionally important part of my job.
Wonderful. Well, look, as we start to close, just building on that last answer, Suzanne, so talk about the fundamentals, the hurdles. What would you share, you know, to the broader employees with disability across the NatWest group and across Purple Space community? What were the key lessons that you would offer them and share with them that you have learnt about building inner confidence?
I think sharing and talking is incredibly important. I've talked about my story from very early on, not because I particularly want to talk about me, but because I want to talk about the issues and what we face. And I think one of the things I've benefited from as being a chair of our Disability and Neurodiversity Network is what I've learned about other conditions and my ability now to support others. And I think you mentioned it earlier on, the looking out, the number of times I have to say to people, don't look down, look up and out. Because there are so many other people, you know, I'm so focused on my mobility experiences. what about the experiences of my neurodivergent colleagues and that. So I think sharing and talking helps us all think and be better colleagues, better family members, better friends, better members of society, because you notice things. So I would say do that to the extent that you feel comfortable. I would say we're very lucky NatWest is a safe place to do that. Reasonable adjustments are available. Process is not always as straightforward as it could be. We continue to work on that, but they are absolutely there. As I say, the bank spent, I don't know how many tens of thousands, changing a listed building door for me, one person. And they did, and there was no question, there was no debate. There was a, there's a timing and there's a process we have to go through because it's listed building, but there was never any really, you know, can't we put you in through the back door, anything like that. So I would encourage people to, if you need something, talk to someone about it, ask for it. And if you feel uncomfortable doing that, come to the network. We can help. We can help you navigate those. But that support is available. And don't be afraid to point out to people things that are difficult. One of the things I found hardest when I became in a senior role was I'd be invited to lots of events where there would be a lot of high tables and lots of standing. And when I was on my crutches to start with, I couldn't stand up. I would have to go sit in a corner. And I'd sit at a table like this, like Billy No Mates. Or quite often, if I'm honest, I would sit in the toilets and cry because I felt so excluded. Look out for those people. Why is someone sitting by themselves? Is there a reason? What can we do? How can we support? And you know, have the confidence to speak up and say, would you mind sitting with me? Because this is what's going to happen. Just find one person. Again, that makes such a huge difference to me when one person comes over. But now I actively say to people, at this event, there's going to be a thing where I won't be able to join in. I'm probably going to sit around the corner. Great, I'll come and sit with you. Like that's all I need. So have confidence to do that.
Wonderful. You are a wonderful advert for NatWest. I hope they're paying you enough for this. You know, seriously, at a time when diversity, equity and inclusion is so challenged, you paint a really positive and strong story of the bank's ability to do good in this world. So look, last question. We have a tradition where we ask our interviewees to pose a question for the next interviewee. So I have a question for you. The notion of superpower and disability is often brought together. Some people are great fans of the notion of superpowers and others less so. But if we position superpower as maybe a unique insight that comes with experiencing disability or difference, what would that be for you?
I think it's probably around resilience. I think resilience is exceptionally important in life, no matter what. We all have great periods and we also have terrible periods, whether it's illness, whether it's bereavement, whether it's career setbacks, whatever it might be. And actually, I think a lot of those in the disability and neurodivergent community have had to be resilient. So actually, when other things come at you, so I've had a few really quite unpleasant work things where you're like, gosh, this is difficult, and you have to dig deep. I sort of know how to do that. And I think that can be quite powerful. And I think it also really helps you not sweat the small stuff. And again, I think you see lots of people fretting over the tiniest things. And you're like, if only, if that was my biggest worry. And again, I think that is quite freeing. So I do think there are some incredible qualities and abilities that come with it that I think are attributes everyone needs as opposed to a superpower. But I do think they give you some incredible strengths that if you harness can be really powerful.
Wonderful. Suzanne, thank you. So I'm going to ask you in the same tradition, is there a question you'd like to ask our next interviewee, Annette from Serco, Annette Moody? What question would you like to ask her?
I think one of the hot topics of the day is still language and the term disability. And I'm quite comfortable describing myself as disabled, but I have many colleagues who meet the definition under the law, but would not describe themselves about that. So I would ask Annette what her sort of take is on that and how she uses the term herself and within her organisation.
Wonderful. That will take us at least 3 hours to unpack.
I think so.
Suzanne, for the moment, fabulous conversation. Thank you for being you. Thank you for your insights and your story. And looking forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you very much for having me.
If we just listened to news headlines or politicians, we would be fooled into believing there are far more disabled people out of work than there are in work. That is not the case. There are millions of people with lived experience of disability, ill health, and neurodivergence who work day in and day out at the same time as navigating very difficult experiences. And they deliver well at work. So if you want to learn more about how to have a confident conversation with your employer, then visit our website, www.purplespace.org. Thank you so much for watching. Now pass on the link.